On this edition of the Scott Radley Show podcast, we are talking about a new poll that seems to say that Canadians aren't just tired of things, they're getting angry. We'll tell you what kind of anger we're talking about and what they're directing their anger at. And I don't know if you heard what Bono had to say about U2, the band and the name, like his band. It wasn't complimentary. Bono is not a fan of U2 by the sounds of it, which is kind of odd, but we're going to talk about that. Stick around.
Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
A poll came out this week. We've got lots of polls these days, but a particularly interesting one I thought came out this week. Actually, yesterday it came out, and it was about Canadians being asked their attitudes towards the unvaxxed. Now, again, when I say a lot of polls, we've had questions like this, but I got to say, when I read the results from this Meru public opinion poll, while I support vaccination, I'm not sure I love the Canadians that we've become all of a sudden, because the results, some of them anyway, boy, they were stark. They were harsh. They were, in some cases, you would almost say bordering on mean. Let me bring in John Wright. He's the executive vice president of Meru Public Opinion. He joins us now. John, thank you for doing this, and I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
I want to start, there's a bunch of ones I want to get to, a bunch of numbers here, but let's start here because this was a huge eye-opener to me, and it goes to what I was just saying about harsh and mean, maybe, whatever else. In your poll, more than half of Canadians say they have no sympathy for those who die of COVID if they haven't had their shots. And John, look, I can understand that people can have their opinions on vaccines and stuff, but I got to say, for Canadians who are supposed to be so nice all the time, that was cold.
Well, this poll is one of four that we've done in the last month, and everything is available up on our site at Meru Public Opinion. And if you take them all together and bind them up, then you get a story. And it's not just focused on how harsh people are. You find, and I'm not defending, you know, their views, I'm just speaking of the data, but one third, 33% of people know someone who can't get medical treatment right now. 39% of people in this country know of treatment that has been postponed or canceled because of the serious medical issues that are now swamping the hospital. I'll get personal for a moment. It didn't influence my poll. My father was diagnosed with prostate cancer in December, and he's had all of his treatments pushed off for at least 3 months. This is what is causing the anger. You know, and I, as I said, I didn't mean to bring in something personal, but
no, that's probably where a lot of this comes from.
Yeah, and it is. And so what we find in our society is about 10% who are very hard on the anti-vax, like, I mean, totally hard, you know, versus 9% of the population on the other side. Then you've got varying degree of what people think should be done. There is no solution in this at the moment. All there is is punitive action. And I think what this does is kind of quantify it. And so the most controversial one in this was people, you know, 26% of people saying that someone should go to jail for not getting a vaccine. It says then that 74% don't want it. And that's kind of where Canadians are. There's a core of people who really want to move this, but they're small. They're not representative of the entire public.
And that's a relief, quite honestly. But for that, you said 20, I think it was 27%. I was shocked by that number, and certain numbers just jump off the page. And you're right, 73% don't want that. But the fact that a quarter of Canadians would say jail for people who are unvaccinated is, again, perhaps they're coming from a place similar to you in the sense that there's a personal position behind this. But boy, that was a stark number, because I can't think that you would find 25, other than a crime, a severe crime, I can't think you'd find 25% of people in this country would want jail for people on almost any other issue.
Well, and we see that in the data. I mean, there's other aspects to the report. It's not just one question, but we do see that 88% of people, I think it is, believe that there's 82%, believe that there should be exemption for people. Like, I mean, we have a sympathetic nature to the vast majority of the country. And I think what's happening here, if you if you open the lines to it, what you're seeing here is a public health system where we pay taxes into it, which is sagging under a disproportionate number of people who are unvaccinated. And that is true. I mean, it may be 50-50 in the ICUs, but it's more unvaccinated by proportion. And it's causing us to think about a two-tier system. It's causing people in this report, at least 60% of Canadians, saying, you know what, you should pay your own way. And in the United States, the same poll shows 24% who refuse to get vaccinated, but that's a choice that they pay for if something happens to them. We don't have that in Canada. I think the bigger issue that's happening right now is when everything gets squeezed down and you can't get in, is there another way to get in? Because if we continue to do this for many, many more months, there's going to be a breaking of the system because you don't have people to work on you and you can't get in. So I think that's a bigger question.
And I have no doubt that, you know, knowing your company and knowing your polling, I'm guessing privatization will be something that you look at down the road, because I agree in the sense, I think that's going to be something that emerges out of this whole issue as a spin-off thing that is going to be a much more of a legitimate or a real discussion than we've ever allowed ourselves to have for generations in this country going forward.
I think you're smack on. What speaks to this is 61% of Canadians who believe that the unvaccinated, if they get COVID, should pay their own price. And I think that is a turning point. You know, there are other punitive things in this, but what we're seeing here is emerging an attitude that if you pay taxes, you're at the front of the line. And if you don't do what everybody else is doing and you're clogging the system, go to the back of the line. And that, you know what? It's not all Canadians saying that, but I think that's where it's coming from.
There is, well, it's the majority. And I saw that, you know, in the numbers, 6 out of 10 roughly support the Quebec model that's been proposed, where you're not just pay for your service or your health care if you get it, but that you will pay a fee if you don't get vaccinated. Again, I mean, look, from a human, from a natural reaction perspective, I get that. You know, I'd love, and I know it's impossible. I've not done a poll. You're the pollster. I'm not the pollster. I know it's impossible to sit down and have a coffee with every person and actually walk through. It's a top of the head reaction. But when you start throwing in things like, well, we know that other existing conditions that could be caused by your lifestyle choices can also lead to terrible outcomes if you get COVID, almost as bad as not being vaccinated, it's a much more complicated thing. But the initial, they're not vaccinated, tax them. It's an easy one to come to.
You know, I got to say something. I've done this polling for 32 years. You know, I worked at Angus Reid, then at Ipsos, now at Maru. I have not experienced anything like this in terms of triggering response to it.
Wow.
Either to us since the Meech Lake Accord. Like, I'm telling you, this is a very serious issue in our society. It is not being dealt with, you know, it's except by punitive measures. And the issue is really, there's a core of 8%, close to 3.5 million Canadians, that are adamant that they will not get the vaccine. And you can be as punitive as you want. And you can look at this report, which actually has their views as well. But you can't take 3.5 million people and squeeze them into corners and then not expect them to have some kind of backlash. So we have to understand that this is a divisive issue. It's going to get to a place where they just won't do it. What do you do?
And this is what
this poll is reflecting.
And one more number, and then we got to run. One more number on this to what you just said. 2/3 of Canadians in your poll favor mandatory vaccines. And again, I'd love to talk to those 2/3 because I'm not doubting their position. I'd love to know what mandatory vaccination would mean, because it's a very, I mean, that becomes, you're into a really complicated ethical and medical and rights and everything else issue with that.
Yeah, there's no question you've hit the nail on the head. The critical thing with polling is that if you take the four that we've done and you put them together, it tells a comprehensive story. These are both actions that governments could take, and frankly, they won't. But what it does is express attitudes, and we're quantifying it. Rather than screaming and yelling that everybody in the country is doing something, you can actually find out that it's this portion versus that portion. I think that is a healthy debate. I think that contributes to a healthy democracy. But the critical issue here is, what do we do with this? And again, I think this is going to eventually end up in talking about a two-tier healthcare system, because there's no other way in which you get through this at the moment. I don't see it, and I don't see anybody making that suggestion, because we've got 8% of people in this country that just will not do this, and yet it's clogging hospitals. So we got to figure out something somewhere.
John Wright, Executive Vice President of Meru Public Opinion. You can go and look this up, Meru, M-A-R-U, if you weren't sure how to spell that. You can go look it up. There is a ton of numbers and information in this poll, way more than we had time to get to today. John, I really appreciate you taking a few minutes, though. Thank you for doing this.
Hey, it's been great to talk to you. Thanks for inviting me.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
I saw this story yesterday, and I said, all right, I'll bite. I'll bite on this one. What is going on here? And the story is that Bono, you know, Bono from U2, Bono was on a podcast the other day, and Bono said a couple things that were pretty interesting about his band and him and other things. First, almost every U2 song makes him cringe, doesn't really like it. And number two, he thinks the name U2 was really pretty stupid. So what do we make of this? Let me bring in a guy we would naturally turn to talk about this. Eric Alper, a music commentator. He's a publicist. He's a writer. He does everything in the world of music, everything perhaps except for, you know, come up with band names. And maybe he's done that too over the years. Eric, have you come up with band names?
No, but I think Eric Alper is a horrible name for anything, anywhere, anybody.
You don't think it would work for a band, Eric and the
Not
Alpers?
At all. No, because I think when you name yourself after a band, it's just boring. Dave Matthews Band sounds awful. Even though it's named after Dave Matthews, it couldn't be less exciting. Actually, Jay Giles actually had the right idea. Jay Giles isn't the lead singer of the Jay Giles Band. That would be Peter Wolf. But then last year, after 50 years, they actually kicked Jay Giles out of the band. So the band is going out on tour named Jay Giles, and Jay Giles isn't even in the band anymore. So be careful when you do that, young artists.
This is not a band, this is a guy, because we know lots of artists have changed their names to sound better on stage, but Arnold Dorsey was, you know, kind of dull. So, of course, if you're Arnold Dorsey and you want to be remembered, you change your name to Engelbert Humperdinck, because who could not remember? I mean, I've always thought that was odd. Anyway, we're going to get to the names in a minute. I want to ask you, though.
That's really interesting, though, because Engelbert Humperdinck would not fit on a T-shirt. The only reason why the manager of U2 loved the band name U2, Bono said in the podcast, was because it looked great on a T-shirt. One letter, one number. Pretty easy.
It is. And I think the first, funny you say that, because the first band T-shirt that I ever owned, I think, was a U2 shirt.
Right. And I think you're lying. I think it really was.
No. I bought it in Australia. I bought it in a flea market or a market in Australia somewhere, and in Sydney, Australia. And I remember having that shirt. And then, unfortunately, it was of such quality that the first time I washed it, my little sister couldn't have worn it. But I got to wear it once.
See, that wouldn't happen with an Engelbert Humperdinck T-shirt, because that name stands for quality.
That name stands for quality, and they have to make them extra large just so they can fit the whole word on there. So it would have shrunk down to size. All right, before we get into the names, because I do want to get into band names for a second here, but what do you make of this whole thing with Bono? Do you really think that he means what he was saying? Or my first thought was, you know, we haven't heard a lot from Bono lately. He's been out of the news. Maybe this is his passive aggressive way of telling all of his fans, I need a little ego stroke, so go on social media and tell me how great I am, that we really are very good and we're not as bad as I said we are. What do you make of this?
I think this is the honest truth from Bono. I think he is one of the most sensitive, less egotistical people in real life, who probably in his deep, darkest moments has no idea why they've sold 350 million copies around the world, to himself. And when he looks at the other members of the band, he will probably think that they are a much better songwriter and musician and leader in this band than he is. But that's what makes him, I think, so great, is because he has the ability to put all that self-doubt aside and become Bono of U2 when he performs or when he gets into a studio. Because I think you have to have a level of mass ego and bombast to be the lead singer of a rock and roll band.
Sure you do.
This song too. So of course some songs are going to sound awful to you. You wrote them in a state of mind where you weren't really, you know, there. You were just portraying the person I think that you wanted to become, that superhero.
Yeah, well, the other thing, and I've always wondered this about musicians, honestly, is when you talk about their work, when you record a song, you are putting down on vinyl or on tape or whatever an interpretation of what you come up with at that moment, and that's it forever. That is now chiseled into stone. That is that song for as long as the world will live. And you can't go back months later and go, yeah, I really wish I'd done that instead. You might wish you had, but that you can't do. So I wonder if he looks back and he hears the songs and he thinks, oh, I would have done that different. Oh, I would have done that. Oh, I don't like the way this is because it's just different now.
And people forget that's actually how music was before records, before like the 1910s. The only way that you could hear a song is literally being in the audience and watching that performer and that singer sing it, which was never done the same way twice. And we're seeing it again now. If you're a 15-year-old pop singer on TikTok, you are probably creating 7 to 10 different versions of that song and changing it every day. You're adding new lyrics. And so that one moment of this is, you know, with or without you, and it will never change. We're seeing big artists do this too, where Kanye West, with his last album, The Life of Pablo, took off 3 songs off of the record 2 weeks after the album was released, added 4 new ones, and took out some lyrics of songs that were already up on Spotify and other streaming services. Imagine if the Beatles right now put Penny Lane on Sgt. Pepper, you know, a song that was really not on the album because they needed a stopgap. So they stuck it on, or that they decided to take off a song that Paul McCartney doesn't really like anymore. Like, it would be blasphemous, but a new generation of music creators are doing this. The version that you hear of a pop song might be different on TikTok than Instagram, than Facebook, than Spotify. So it's really interesting that what you just said, that forever might be a thing of the past in about 5 years if this is going to be the norm.
Well, I always wonder if that's the thought process when you go to a concert. There are some performers who get up there and play the song true to the way it was written, and others you get up there and they are going on a free-form exploration of whatever that song might have been and doing something wild. And I always wonder if they were recording it today, if that's how it would sound, because that's now what they think is the better sound.
Yeah, and especially because there's so many reasons why the song is never finished, and artists, and I've always asked this artist too, whenever I talk to them, it's like, how did you know that song was done? Like, was it just the gut feeling? And most often than not, they'll say, if they didn't drag me out of the studio, I would still be there recording that song, because either the record label or the manager put pressure and said, we got to go. Like, we're going out on tour next week. We have to finish this record. So deadlines were super important to people finishing a song. But, you know, Glenn Frey from the Eagles once said that if they had drum machines back in the 70s, they would still be recording Hotel California.
Hmm. Yeah. You know? So that was, well, don't we all? But Eric, don't we all do that?
Finish songs and some people don't.
Don't we all do that? I mean, I really believe that unless you're an idiot or you have an ego that is so enormous that you can't see past yourself, we all would change things that we've done in our work or whatever. We would all look back and go, you know, I when I write for the paper, I often will go back, oh, I wish I'd reworded that. I wish I'd done that different. When I have a guest on, there's times I wish I asked different questions. I think we all would do this. The difference is, again, our stuff, people don't really think about it after we've done it, most of it. U2 or other bands, people listen to it every single day for the rest of time.
Yeah, and I do it every day, and I have no artistic talent whatsoever. My wife looks at the kitchen once every 6 months and said, we need to redo this, or we need to do something. And we do that every day. We always try to make our lives better, and musicians try to do that as well with every new concert or every new tour, just to jam it up and change it around, because they get bored of doing the same thing as well. But that's where you end up with, you know, usually bands that kind of do that are like the Grateful Dead or Yes or Anderson Bruford, Wakeman and Howe, or whatever they decide to name their band this year. But it's those bands that are able to kind of stretch what a 3.5 minute song is into something like 17 minutes. Radiohead does this very, very well right now.
Yeah. And I've been, there's one in particular, and I won't name the band because my memory is somewhat, you know, it's a long time ago and I don't want to, but there was a band that we went to and there was a song I liked, and all of a sudden it was exactly what you said. It was a 17 minute version of a guitar solo that it was like, okay, are we just filling time here? Or are you, is this your artistic expression? Like, did you, is someone going to the bathroom and we didn't notice them leave the stage? So you're just, you know, here, speaking of that, and it just popped into my head as we're talking, U2 at Live Aid. Yeah. Ironic, we're talking about U2. The famous story of which song was it? What was it? Back. Which song?
Yeah.
Okay. And Bono left the stage, and the way the stage was, the band couldn't see him. He was going to help some woman who had collapsed at the front of the audience. They had no idea where he was, so they just kept playing the same riff for like 8 minutes.
Yep. Yep, that's exactly it. They were supposed to do 4 songs. They ended up doing 1. They did bad. And Bono saw somebody in the front row at Live Aid that was struggling to breathe and get some air, went down, pulled her out, and started dancing with her in front of the entire world.
Except for the band, who couldn't see him.
So mad that they felt that they had blown their chance of worldwide success because of this. The band split up. And actually, it was Bono who ended up saying that 6 months later, he was hitchhiking somewhere in Ireland, and some car passed him by and said that was a great performance on Live Aid. And that gave him the kind of strength and courage to know that he had done the right idea. But you're exactly right. Moments like that, you cannot, talking about Live Aid, it's funny. Like, and I know we're going so off topic, but that whole, you know, the greatest set ever, recorded or performed is kind of deemed to be the Queen set at Live Aid. That whole thing of Freddie Mercury doing a call and response wasn't even supposed to happen. They rushed to the stage, and that was Freddie Mercury's literal vocal warm-ups that he does backstage, but he didn't even have any time to do it. So he did it not knowing that 90,000 people would actually scream that stuff back to him.
But what was the other part of that set? The part of it, now there's a lot of things, but that particular set, what was the other thing though that made it so good is that Queen stayed very true to what they'd written. So when people heard the music, they heard the songs as they knew them, as they were familiar with them, as they loved them. They didn't do something that made it a new try at something where everyone goes, eh. They all knew every song and the tune.
Yeah, exactly. There was only one artist that day at Live Aid that did a new song that people didn't hear, and that was Adam Ant.
Who was that?
Okay. Adam Ant, and he was the only artist to actually drop in sales that week in the UK. Everybody else did the classic hits. But speaking of, Queen, good name or bad name?
Well, it depends what you're going after. Right. I think with Freddie Mercury, it was probably pretty close.
Right. If you were surprised that Freddie Mercury was gay after he named his band Queen, maybe you think that that's a bad name. But pretty great name there.
All right. So if Bono thinks U2 is stupid, I don't have a problem with U2. Of all the band names out there that I would say are stupid. And there's a lot of them. And in fact, when I started looking through today to refresh my memory, most of the ones that I would count as stupid, I can't even mention on the radio because they're stupid because they're just so obscene. Nonetheless, I wouldn't count U2 as being a stupid band name. But okay, there are a ton out there. Give me one or two that you put at the top of your list for dumbest ever band names.
I think the Beatles is a horrible name.
It's true.
I love them. You know I love them, but it's a bad pun on the crickets that for 50, 60 years we've been talking about the Beatles with the one of the worst band names ever.
Speaking of animals, I would put on that list, and I know that it worked. I know. And see, here's the thing. It can be a stupid name that still really works. And some of these, they're so stupid that they stick with us, which I suppose means that, you know, they're kind of good. But I think Hootie and the Blowfish is absolutely ridiculous. Just like,
yeah, especially because for years and years and years, they were complaining that people were coming up to them asking which one was Hootie.
Yeah. And, well, and that's because the name, I did not know this until today. Again, when I'm going through and reminding myself, Hootie was a friend of theirs from university. And there was another guy who looked like a blowfish who had the nickname. So that's where it came from. Another one, Toad the Wet Sprocket.
Yeah, that's an awful name. That's you know, and it's funny because it comes from Monty Python's skit. And Monty
Does
Python
it?
is a great name for a comedy troupe because there's nobody in there that recognizes or even comes close to an actual name like Monty Python.
I think maybe near the top of my list of names that I can repeat on the radio, I would say, though, that Chumbawamba is, it sounds a lot like a Star Wars character who's big and furry.
Chumba's great, actually. That was what they used to, in the local pub, instead of men and women on the bathroom doors, it was either Wamba or Chumba. And nobody's been able to figure out which one was women and which one was men. But Wamba, I think, is women, and then Chumba was men. So that's how they actually figured out what that name is. But to look at that and say, that's what I'm going to name my band. That's the talent, right?
Like, I would say if it's in a pub, that's the liquor.
Right. Like, you can say that The Doors is a dumb name, but The Doors was based on The Doors of Perception that was based on the book. By Adolf Huxley. It's an okay name. It's not exciting, but the fact that it mirrors exactly what you think and how they wanted the band to be perceived. A little trippy, a little spacey, a little in your mind, The Doors of Perception. It's pretty great.
What about Limp Bizkit?
Limp Bizkit is a dumb name for dumb people who love dumb music. That's 9-year-old boys giggle at that name, and that's exactly, I think, who their audience was at the time. But even back then, like, you know, about cartoonies, like Fallout Boy, which was a huge band in the 90s, they were actually Fallout Boy, with Fallout being one word, but then they were afraid that the Simpsons would sue them because there's a character on their show called Fallout Boy. And so they actually had to have three separate words for Fallout Boy in order to kind of not be sued from them.
Okay, three more really stupid ones from me. Then if you want to throw a couple more in, up to you. The Alan Parsons Project, only because it's just so, great band, but just like...
It's so snooty.
That's a good word for it. It really is. Smashing Pumpkins, another great band that I love, but every time now I hear that, I think of that Punkin Chunkin or whatever you call it, that thing they do in the Midwest.
Right.
And I do think, though, the all-time dumbest name for any band ever by a group that probably thought they were being incredibly clever, The.
Okay, so let me ask you something, because I don't know how much time we have. Do you think Smashing Pumpkins, is it pumpkins that have been smashed or good-looking pumpkins, and it's another word for smashing? Like, you look smashing tonight, darling.
I'm not sure that when I look at Billy Corgan, I'm thinking smashing in that way, but maybe some will.
It's the latter. That's how we meant it. He didn't actually mean it by, like, broken pumpkins or smashed pumpkin. He meant it as really good-looking pumpkins. But that's the story, and I think he's sticking to it.
As good-looking pumpkins go, it's still better than porno for pyros. Which is,
I know,
this
is so great. Like, you can go out all night, all night. Linkin Park, the reason why it's spelled Linkin instead of Lincoln, like Abraham Lincoln, was because LincolnPark.com was actually trademarked and it was used by a URL from the actual Linkin Park in Washington. So they just went goofy and they just changed it to Lincoln, Linkin.
There are explanations for all of them, but I don't think...
Good.
I don't think U2 falls into that category, that basket of deplorables, as Hillary Clinton would say. I think it's actually better than Bono's giving himself credit for. Eric Alper, we always love doing this. Thanks for taking a few minutes today.
No problem. Happy to do it. We'll talk soon.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
I'm not just a pawn in this game.
Three nights a week on Global.
They're putting targets on their back. Massive.
Drama.
I guess you could say I'm in a showman.
They're just so in love and so annoying. Enough.
Betrayal.
The guy just put up his best friend now.
And plot twists.
What is happening right now?
You'll never see coming.
If you're coming for me,
this is perfect.
I'm coming for you then.
It'll be a battle.
Like, it'll be war.
Big Brother Canada. All new Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Sundays on Global. Stream on Stack TV.